Hello there, welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. I hope life is treating you well and I hope you enjoy the next half hour or so as we look at stories involving a major Irish jumps trainer having his license suspended, a debate around geldings in Europe's greatest flat race, and some cracking action over the weekend at Longchamp and Haydock. My name is Lee Mottishead and the gentleman sitting to my left, not long back from Japan and the Asian Racing Conference, is Jonathan Harding. Hello.
Morning, Lee.
Are you still feeling the Japanese vibe?
Very much so, yeah. It was a good week, good appraisal of the state of global racing. Spoiler alert, there's a bit of work to be done there. Food was great, company was great, so yeah, good week.
Glorious. And in Paris at Saint-Cloud Racecourse is our France correspondent, Scott Burton. Hello, Scott.
Hello there, Lee. Jonathan, I can still feel a bit of a Japanese vibe from being at Longchamp yesterday, where Shin Emperor had his last hit out before he comes across to the Irish Champions Stakes at Leopardstown. And he looked in good terms with himself. So, yes, a bit of Japanese vibes going everywhere at the moment.
And are you still on an Olympics / Paralympics high?
Very much so. The weather, as you will have seen for the closing ceremony last night, has reverted to what it was for the opening ceremony. I think we're all due a bit of a come down, but I was very lucky to be at the Stade de France on Saturday evening for the last night of the para athletics. And fantastic, full crowd, all singing Edith Piaf. It was great, and some fantastic performances as well. It's been a fantastic summer of sport here.
Yeah, it was great to watch. And Scott, what is that? Is it Champs-Élysées, that song that everyone seems to be singing around the stadium on regular intervals?
Yes, yeah, that's what they're singing. It's a bit of a hoary old classic here. You get to hear, I have to tell you, on the Saturday evening, the very last track race, there was a fall right near the end. It was a very, very long stewards' inquiry. And so they took a long time to have the medal ceremony, and we had several renditions of Champs-Élysées and a lot of other old hoary French pop classics, but people entered into the spirit of it and they were dancing in the aisles. It was great.
Yeah, it looked marvellous. It looked marvellous. Not marvellous, regrettably, is the subject matter of our first story, which Jonathan is going to bring us now.
Yeah, so the big news story last week really was Shark Hanlon, King George winning trainer, very popular trainer, having his licence suspended for 10 months and being fined €2,000, for transporting a dead horse in an open trailer attached to a branded lorry in June. So a highly regrettable incident. An IHRB referral committee essentially described it as grossly negligent, talking about the reputational damage to the sport that this has caused. While Hanlon has not defended what he's done, he's admitted to what he's done, but saying that it was essentially an honest mistake and that the penalty handed out to him is much too severe. He's going to be appealing that. It's worth noting he also has the option to apply for 5 months of the 10-month suspension suspended. Suspension, yes. Suspended. So I was getting
always tricky, that one.
Too many suspensions, yeah. Suspended. So it's just a very high profile incident. It's a big trainer losing their license for 10 months, and it's done the sport no good, really, from an optics point of view.
And in relation to Shark Hanlon, of course, he'd already this year, my goodness, he's been everywhere. He featured heavily in ITV's Champions Full Gallop opening episode in relation to Hewitt's King George. He was part of, or he appeared in, again, not for great reasons, the RTE Investigates programme. That was a grim watch. But also, on the very day that this announcement came through regarding the IHRB suspension, there was also social media footage of Bedelia, a filly he had trained, left the yard in June and was then shown in a really unfortunate social media post. Terrible.
Yes, yeah, and seeing a horse in that sort of condition is very is difficult to see. And what I would say is that these things, while in isolation might seem like mistakes or miscommunication or what have you, when they are amplified on social media, they become much more serious, which is why I know there has been some, and it's difficult to talk too much about the suspension because there's an appeal process going on, and sort of I think the length of the suspension is between Shark Hanlon and the IHRB to kind of thrash out and decide and what have you. But I think if you take every case on its merits, I mean, I'm a big fan of the fact that it is being taken seriously, let's put it that way, and that the sentence, the punishment handed out is serious, because I don't think you can understate the damage that this causes, whether it's an innocent mistake or not. A horse in being transported, a carcass being transported in that manner, is not showing the necessary respect that the sport is sort of hinges on, really, the respect and love of the thoroughbred. So, yeah, it's an unfortunate from so many angles, and we've just got to wait and see now what happens with the appeal.
Yes. Scott, obviously, Shark Hanlon has described himself as surprised and disappointed by the suspension. He's outlined why he thinks this was something that he didn't obviously set out to, didn't set out for it to happen. The tarpaulin came off the vehicle that was carrying the deceased horse. I think the way Shark Hanlon has described it was just an unfortunate chain of events. But the RHOB also found him guilty in the announcement of obfuscation and inconsistency of accounts, having previously charged him with providing false and misleading information to IHRB investigators. So it's a difficult story, this, Scott, but as Jonathan said, there's surely no doubt that what actually happened, not only was it enormously disrespectful to the horse involved and hugely distressing, I guess, to people who saw the horse, but it must have been damaging to racing's reputation.
Absolutely. I think the trouble with a lot of these stories is you're pushing an open door in terms of perception with certain sections of the public who maybe don't have a great connection to racing from one big story to the next, and possibly, you know, remember the Gordon Elliott situation where he was pictured on social media. We have to remember that everybody has a camera in their pocket these days. And as much as regulators in Britain or France or Ireland will do their absolute best to be vigilant and to try and catch any situation where a license holder doesn't uphold the absolute highest standards, it's almost guaranteed that it's actually going to be a member of the public or a disgruntled employee or whoever it might be who's actually going to catch this, and it's going to come out on social media. It would be lovely to think that the IHRB in this case, or the BHA in Britain, or France Gallo, would be able to pick up on any slight area where people have fallen below the very, very highest standards and be able to sort this out in-house. But it is almost destined to come out on social media, and I think it's right that the authorities take it extremely seriously. Jonathan was at the Asian Racing Conference. I know a lot of the conversations at the very highest level are about racing social license. And it's very easy for us within racing to say, well, you know, there's not a welfare issue because, you know, regrettably the horse had already died. This was just this is regrettable optics. It's less important than many things you can get a ban for. But if we're serious about promoting the sport as having the very, very highest ethical standards, then I think we have to take it seriously. And certainly, I'm not suggesting that it would be nice for regulators to be able to sort this out and quiet it not to become a story. I think we have to be open and honest when, for whatever reasons, be they accidental or just a lack of communication or whatever might have been the reason, those standards slip below the very, very highest ones that we expect of our practitioners.
Yeah, I think that's right. And obviously, there was a lot of reference to the social, the filming of the horse, and the fact that went public. But even without that, this shouldn't have happened. It's not acceptable. John, on the Bedelia situation, this raises a number of really important questions for the sport as well, in that the horse Bedelia raced for Shark Hanlon in mid-June, left the yard, I think, 4 days after her final race for the stable. Shark Hanlon said that he believed he was selling her, that she was going to someone he'd sent horses to in the past. She then ended up with a dealer. Shark Hanlon makes a point that when she left his yard, she was in great condition. Where, therefore, does responsibility lie? Obviously, the person at fault is whoever has let the horse get into a terrible condition, horribly malnourished. But, of course, racing can't rely on people like that necessarily to always look after horses as they should be. This horse had a trainer. Bedelia had a syndicate ownership. There were two previous owners. She was a breeder. She had a breeder. Where, ultimately, is responsibility going to lie? And surely, in Britain and in Ireland, there needs to be more financial resource pumped into this whole post-racing aftercare sector.
Yeah, and you've hit the nail on the head there with you need to essentially invest in it. Ideally, you'd have traceability from the moment a foal hits the ground to when they eventually die, hopefully having enjoyed a wonderful second career or life with somebody else. Now, what happens in between and where the dots join up is slightly more complicated, because at the moment, a great deal of it relies on connections that a trainer might have or an owner might have. So they might know somebody, they might be able to rehome them with somebody that they trust. But naturally, in that sort of situation, with so many horses in the population, you're going to have some that will slip through the cracks. So it's about investing in creating those pathways, I think, to the second career and establishing more places and almost fallbacks for when you can't find a loving home with someone that you have a close personal connection to, then having that system in place that means they don't end up in the wrong hands. It was a big, again, to go back to the Asian Racing Conference, there was an IFAR conference there, the International Forum for the Aftercare of Racehorses. There is a lot of work going on here with the World Horse Welfare, with the Welfare Board, and all the rest of it. So it is on the agenda, it just needs to happen very quickly. And I think it's worth saying that Britain, I can speak for Britain, is a little way ahead of a lot of other countries, but there is still work to be done, certainly, with the investment that is needed to ensure that we don't have situations like the one that we saw in Ireland.
Yeah, in terms of where the money comes from to really resource it as it should be, lots of different ideas. I mentioned in the column maybe something to do with sales ring proceeds or from sales company revenue, but there are lots of different options for it if the sport was prepared to do that, as it does in some other jurisdictions. Scott, in France, how big an issue is this in France as well in terms of what happens to racehorses after they've racing and who has responsibility for them?
Well, France was quite slow on the uptake on aftercare, but I have to say they've made up for lost time. The organisation here, Au-delà des Pistes, which roughly translates as after the race course, they have become an exceptionally effective, not only administrative body in terms of licensing second homes and also retraining centres, because a lot of ex-race horses will find a great loving final home, but they will need to be retrained first. They need to basically unlearn being highly wired athletes. And so a lot of what Au-delà des Pistes does is to do with licensing and accrediting those retraining centres. They have actually made a bit more of a breakthrough here financially as well, in that France Gallo having appointed them as their chief retraining and aftercare provider, provide some money from the PMU, and also Arcana, the main sales company here as of last year, I think, maybe beginning of this year, give a small percentage of their turnover as well. It's not probably as much as some people in the aftercare sector would like, but it's a good start, and I think it's a good model for other sales companies in Europe to follow. And I think, as I say, it's 2016, you can trace it only back that far, that there was really a concerted effort. And it was really some concerned individuals in the breeding industry, oddly enough. It was Godolphin and the Aga Khan studs were involved. A couple of other still large studs, but probably less internationally known as well, Arad Montague and people like that. It was concerned people who felt that, you know, we're all in this sport because we love horses. And to use the phrase that's very well put by the Horse Welfare Board's strategy document in Britain, all racehorses deserve a life well lived. And it's a cradle to grave scenario. So, yes, there is Definitely a lot more awareness of it within the sport here. I'm not actually sure amongst the general French public, there's a great deal of thought one way or the other about it, really. And once in a blue moon, there will be a kind of a documentary on a general television channel that talks about welfare of racehorses, and then there's a big kind of thought about it. But it's actually more coming from within the sport that people feel that we really need to do better. And as I say, the Au-delà de Piste, they also raise money here from donations from the two biggest meetings here. So they have the Arc Promise and the Grand Steeplechase Promise, which is something that's based on the aftercare model in the United States that you, trainers, owners, breeders, jockeys pledge a certain percentage of their winnings from Breeders' Cup weekend, for instance, and it's something that they've taken on here, and they've raised quite a lot of money doing that as well. So, and that's not restricted to the French trainers and jockeys and breeders and what have you. Some of the British and Irish jockeys that have come over for Arc weekend have pledged money as well. So, it's a very active debate here, but very much within the sport. They're trying to be on the front foot about it, and all power to them.
Yeah, indeed. And wherever a race takes place, that jurisdiction, that sport has to be on the front foot, as Scott says. That then brings us to the end of part one of this week's Front Page. We'll be talking about geldings in part two, but first, some exciting news about WhatsApp Insider. Welcome back to part two of the Front Page, and now we are going to have a debate about geldings in which Scott Burton and myself will have a polite difference of opinion. Scott Burton.
Well, I have to thank you firstly for bringing this to back to the top of the racing agenda in last week's Monday column. The idea that the Breeders' Arc de Triomphe is something of an outlier in still restricting the entry to just colts and fillies, no geldings allowed. Obviously this year, that means the two best middle distance horses in France, potentially, we don't know, Luc de Vega might take that crown. But Goliath, who was deeply impressive in winning the King George, and also Flandigan, who also trained by Francis Clafard, was the only horse that really put it up to City of Troy in the International, and before that won by six lengths in the King Edward at Royal Ascot. Neither of those are entered in the Arc because neither of them have the right to run. I don't too much want to Bracey, your view on this. I've obviously spoken to various people within French racing this week. Edward de Rothschild, the former president of France Gallo, came up with an intriguing suggestion about adding an extra couple of pounds so that geldings could run in the Arc, but they'd have to carry more weight than the colts on the basis that his trainer, André Farb, we also spoke to Sir Mark Prescott as well, both of them felt that the gelding operation improves those horses that have it, actually make them more resistant to training or just improves their temperament, makes them a better horse than they personally would have been, even though that doesn't necessarily make them better in the general population. And also, most importantly, France Gallo revealed that amongst the topics that will be up for discussion is part of their strategic plan, which is labelled 2030, but is going to come into effect a lot earlier than that, is the fact that they will revisit the subject in terms of whether they should open the Arc, not this year, but in future years, to geldings, along with the one other all-age race in Europe which has that restriction, which is the Prix Jacques Le Maroir over a mile at Deauville. So that's the way it's all played out. I'll let you go first, shall I?
Well, yeah, bless you. I mean, I've always had a bee in my bonnet about this one, in that I would open up all races to geldings, as you see in other jurisdictions like America and Australia that also have very well-developed, extremely commercial breeding industries. However, even if you put the classics to one side, I think for the Arc and the Jacques Le Marois, I think the argument for bringing geldings into the race is powerful. Generally, the argument against, well, there are two main arguments, it seems to me, that are used for not having geldings in these races. One is that they are stallion-making races. I'm not sure you can say the Arc is a stallion-making race, in the sense that obviously lots of Arc winners have gone to stud, but I would argue that they were stallion-made by the time they won the Arc, as compared to winning classics. But also that argument about geldings or horses are improved by the gelding process. Now, it might well be entirely true, and certainly there's logic to say that temperament-wise, they will be improved by the gelding process. And I can see, therefore, why Edouard de Rothschild made his argument that you have penalties for geldings in the Arc, they carry a bit more weight. But I think often it's presented as fact when it's more of an opinion. I remember doing a special report on geldings, I don't know, 2-3 years ago for the Racing Post. And certainly there was split opinion on what the gelding process did in terms of a horse's ability. Chris Waller, top Australian trainer who's trained plenty of top class entires and geldings, argued that he thinks actually colts and entires are better relative to geldings because of the muscle mass and steroid boost, if you like, that they have as entires as opposed to as geldings. And even James Tate, successful trainer in Britain and also a vet, now he wouldn't want to change the rules, or he certainly didn't do when we spoke before, but he did say that he believed relative to the two that it's entire horses that have an advantage over geldings because, as I say, of that muscle mass, steroids, hormonal angle. So I think that in itself is not a reason to not have geldings in the Arc, and I therefore, for that reason, I don't agree with Edouard de Rothschild's suggestion, or it's welcome that he's coming up with a constructive proposal. It just seems to me that if you have a situation whereby you are running all Europe's all-aged Group 1 races, with the exception of the Marois and the Arc, with geldings in them, it seems to me bizarre not to have the same rule for the Marois and the Arc, as great as they are, particularly the Arc. It seems to me that if we're saying, as a point of principle, it wouldn't be fair to have geldings in the race, why is it fair then for Calandigan to be running in the Jumbo International? Why would it be fair for Goliath to be winning a King George VI and Queen Elizabeth Stakes? And I just think that the Arc should be about finding who is Europe's greatest middle distance thoroughbred. And I think there'll be a handful of occasions when that might be a gelding. But when it is, I'd like to see the gelding in the race, because for me, I want the Arc to produce the best horse in any particular season. And this year, there's a fair chance that that won't be the case. That, my lord, is the case for the prosecution. Scott.
Well, if the prosecution rests, I'll try not to go on for too long, because I've got lots of... I can't disagree with the actual sporting logic of it. In any other sport, you would not look at trying to take a whole potential population of champions out of the equation. I think I can boil it down to three main objections. The first, on a very practical level, is that the Arc is already an exceptionally successful race. And if you look at some other races that have previously been restricted in, maybe something like the Irish St. Ledger would be a good example, which now is open to older horses. The reason you tend to change these races or make them as open as possible is because you're in danger of not having competitive racing. So the Irish Ledger was a race that wasn't really thriving, and now it's become much more of a race that's just another, it's less of a classic and more of another good, well-funded staying race over a mile and six. Curra, very fair track, usually attracts a very, very good field. The Arc, you can count on the fingers of one hand the last time, the number of times in the last 25 years when there's been less than about 14 runners. It's been statistically the world's best race in four of the last 7 years. It's not a race that's struggling. It frequently fields very, very full fields, as I say. You only have to go back 2 years to the fact that they busted over the 20 runner limit. Now, that's the first time that any horse has faced being balloted out in ARC history, because the 20 runner safety limit was only there again about 25 years old. And you don't have to go back that far. You go back to watch films of ARCs in the late 70s and you get 24, 25 runners. Longchamp can take it, although it's not necessarily ideal because the draw becomes an even bigger issue. And so the ARC is a very successful race, not least of which because it's worth 5 million euros. It dwarfs everything else in Europe. So my problem is not that a horse like Calandagan or Goliath would get a run. It's that if you let Calandagan and Goliath in, you let every other gelding that's got a vaguely okay rating over a mile and a half, and then you will get in a situation where, which happens a lot in America and Australia, and they have a very different racing culture, but you will end up in a situation with horses getting balloted out. And by the nature of the way that the pattern works in Europe, that's going to disadvantage fillies and mares to a certain extent. The two most high-profile horses that missed out 2 years ago when the ARC was oversubscribed were Very Elegant, who, let's face it, had travelled halfway around the world and was a superstar in Australia, and also La Parisienne, Carlos and Jan Lerner's runner-up, only beaten a neck in the Prix de Diane, but because she'd only ever run against female opposition, she didn't have a sufficient rating to make one of the top 20. So it's fine to say that Goliath and Calandagan are absolutely worth their place. But I did the calculations going back to 2012. And I think Cirrus de Zegler obviously had a rating of 131 the year he was second to Frankel in the Champions Stakes. But with the exception of that, if you look at last year as being a very average renewal of the ARC, the third place horse, Ernesto, had a rating of 123. That's what it took to get placed in the ARC. Last year, the ARC was the third best race in the world. It wasn't the best race in the world. It was behind two races that Equinox ran in. And to find the number of middle distance geldings since Cirrus de Zegler who've run to 123 and therefore might have got placed, I think there's two of them. So this is, you're creating extra issues potentially for the fillies and mares, purely for a once in a 10, 12 year occurrence. So to me, you're taking a small problem and you're risking much bigger problems.
Scott, I think that's a, you know, really well made argument, and loads of people are going to agree with you on it. I suppose all I'd say is if you look at the other big group ones in Europe, particularly the middle distance races, there aren't that huge number of geldings who are trying to get into race. Look at the Irish Champions Stakes on Saturday. I think maybe Anmark will be in the race, but I'm not sure there'll be many others. You would still fear, would you, that there would be a rush of geldings trying to get into the ARC?
Not about a rush exactly, but it's, like I say, it's a 5 million euro race. I think, you know, if you look at the richest races in Britain and Ireland, you're looking at 1.25 million for the Judmont International. I think it's a similar kind of figure for the Royal Bahrain Irish Champion, a little bit more maybe for the champion on Kipco Champions Day. But it's an enormous difference. And I think the notion that you wouldn't get just those kinds of horses, even those horses in recent years, you think of horses like Lord North or Dubai Honor, who've been at least as successful, a day would be another one, at least as successful over a mile and a quarter. You're going to try for a mile and a half because even, you know, if you don't stay, you don't stay, but you're running for 5 million euros. I think I'm not against the idea of exploring this, and I'm not actually against the idea completely of geldings running in the ARC. I just think that people need to be aware of all the different parameters. And if we end up in a situation much more like the United States and Australia, where we get used to the idea of having to run a kind of points road to the ARC or something, they do that here for the Prix de l'Amérique, the main trotting race. So you could introduce a thing like that. You could be almost guaranteed a full field of, say, 20 every year. that's a worthwhile avenue pursuing, but I don't think it's just as simple as just saying it's fairer, let's just do it. I think you just have to be aware of the consequences of exploring it.
Scott, just one last question. Aside from obviously we have a slight disagreement on this, I'm sure we can debate it again in Paris first weekend of October. But do you think there will be any change?
I think eventually it will come, yes. I'm not absolutely sure it'll be this time round, but I think they last looked at this in 2019 when the race we may come on to talk about in a minute, the Brie du Moulin was opened up to geldings, and also a few of what used to be called the Poules de Perdrix, the various trial races for the Poules d'Essai des Poulains and the Prix du Jockey Club were opened up. Ironically, this weekend we'll have the Prix Niel and the Prix Foire, who since the 2020 runnings have been open to geldings, so you can win the trial race, but you then can't go on to the Arc. So the fact that they're revisiting it only 5 years after the last time they looked at it, I think there must be the more people within France Gallo who think it's probably time for a change. I've no idea whether that includes the new president, Guillaume de Saint-Seine, or his head of the his vice president in charge of the flat, Arnaud de Saisseil. I don't know what their personal opinions are, but I think the fact that we're coming back to it again after only 5 years means if it's not this time, it will be at some stage, probably in the next 15 years, I would have thought.
One thing I would say, Scott, is that you have the majority of opinion on your side. Chris Cook, in his front runner email last week, had a poll of readers and it ended 51.2% pro maintaining the status quo, 48.8% against allowing geldings into the race. So you win, I lose, I would just don't have it. It was remarkably similar to the Brexit final vote. So once again, I'm on the losing side. We move on now to part three, but not until we tell you all about Racing Post Members Club. Our final story this week then is about a cracking weekend of racing action. Scott was at Longchamp on Sunday for the Moolah. I was at Haydock on Saturday for the Betfair Sprint Cup, which was won by six-year-old gelding Montessib, beat three-year-old Entire Kind of Blue in a ding-dong finish. Huge win for Kieran Fallon, a local lad born in Cambridge but raised in Wigan. His mum, Judy Fallon, is known as Wigan Julie on X, formerly known as Twitter. She was absolutely delighted. Kieran's aunt Anne was at Haydock as a volunteer chaplain and also to cheer him on. Huge win for the family, huge win for Kieran, who has had a lot of bad luck with injury in the last 12 months or so. He broke his back in two places in July, but remarkably was back in no time at all. Anne was winning his third Group 1 race at Haydock on Saturday with Montasib, emotional for the family on a number of levels, not least because in all their thoughts was Stefano Kirky, who lost his life earlier this year. Stefano had been the partner of Kieran's sister, Brittany. They were thinking of him. It was a big win, as I say, for Montasib, who now heads on to Kipco British Champions Day when Connections, William Haggis and others think Soft Ground we'll actually see him in an even better light than we saw him at Haydock. At Longchamp on Sunday, a deeper, higher quality Group 1 in the Prix de Moulin produced, not for the first time, a shock victory for a front-running pacemaker. Tribalist, who went from the front under Mikel Barcelona, trained by Andre Farb, made all the running to win the Moulin with big guns Charin, Henry Longfellow, and notable speech in his wake. You looked, Charin, probably an unlucky loser, but Tribalist to say, not the first horse to do what he did at Longchamp or indeed around the turning mile at Ascot. Before we talk about Haydock then, Scott, fascinating Moulin to watch. Could you sort of see it happening as it was unfolding from the grandstands?
Yeah, it became obvious kind of just getting towards the bottom of the full straight that he got a good break on them, and this is a horse, he's all his best form is actually the other way around, left-handed, where I am today at Saint-Cloud. Louis Binard, who is Godolphin's representative in France, joked after he won the Group Two here, the Prix de Muguet, in May, that France Gallo needed to institute a Group One over a mile at Saint-Cloud and call it the Prix Tribalist or Prix Tribalist. So he has shown all his form the other way around. He hasn't actually run at Longchamp all that often, but you know that he goes from the front. You know that he stays a mile well. Without wishing to sound like I'm after timing, because I couldn't necessarily see Tribalist winning the race, but in the setup piece for Sunday's Racing Post, I did pose the question that it was fairly obvious Tribalist would go from the front. I thought also maybe that Ramadan might as well, and that there was an intriguing tactical dilemma for both Ryan Moore on Henry Longfellow and especially for Sylvester D'Souza on Charin, is how much rope to give them, because neither of those horses were pacemakers. They were both in on their own merits, and they're both good horses. Were they good enough to stay in front? Probably against that caliber of opposition, not. But if they just got enough of a break on them, as you point out, it's a race that this has happened in before. Maxios made all to beat Olympic Glory, and then more recently Pinatubo got done by a very excellent. A fine front-running ride from Pierre Charles Boudeau on Persian King. So it happens in this race not infrequently. Longchamp is one of those, it's downhill for quite a long way, and you can make up cheap lengths in the what they call the descent before the full straight and then turning into the straight without really going for everything. And he was very, very tough at the end there. Clearly, Charing came home very, very fast. Roger Varian was very, very charitable in defeat. He takes these things very, very well. He obviously congratulated the winning connections, and he certainly wasn't in any mood to throw Sylvester D'Souza under the bus. You only get one go at these things, don't you? And it's a very fine judgment. He was probably six or seven lengths behind turning in. He's been beaten a length and a quarter. In another five or six strides, he would have got up, but he just left it that little bit too late. But it was a fascinating race to watch unfold in front of you. And my first thought afterwards was, how has that happened? But actually, as I say, Longchamp folklore will tell you that it happens more often than you think. So well played to Mikel Barcelona, and a good piece of training by André Farb, even though he very much tried to bat any notion of that away and wanted to put all the praise on the horse yesterday.
Yeah, I also noted he's very good in batting away praise from Mikel Barcelona as well, stressing it was all down to Tribalist. I use the word pacemaker, as Scott said, he clearly wasn't a pacemaker. His form before that indicated he was way too good to be doing that, and he might now head on to a Breeders' Cup mile. Do you think Charm was unlucky?
Yeah, I don't know about unlucky. I think he's run well enough to win the race. I think it was just a case of, as Scott suggests, just a very fine margin. If he'd gone slightly earlier, you'd think he'd have won that reasonably comfortably, actually, in the end, because Notable Speech never really went on that ground, didn't see that turn of foot that we've become so excited by. So yeah, I wouldn't be, you'd be disheartened if you're connected to the horse, but if you're following the horse, I mean, it's just a case of he's still very good. I still think he's the best horse in the race, Charon. It just didn't happen for him on the day, because that's how sport works. I think if you ran it another nine times, he'd win nine times.
Yeah, and I think if you fancied him beforehand for the QE2, you would probably fancy him even more now, even though he's been beaten in the Moulin.
Yeah, he's run it. And look, respect to the winner, is a good horse. It's not a case of a complete freak result. He's a talented horse in his own right, as they were quite keen to stress afterwards. But I think if they had their time again, perhaps going a little bit sooner, Charon would have, as Scott said, would have got up on the line.
Scott, do you want a quirky little fact?
Yeah, go for it.
Here's my quirky little fact. Doncaster's opening meeting of the season, Charon won the Doncaster Mile. It's gone on to be a Group 1 star. Montasib won the Camage Trophy and went on to be a Group 1 star, winning the Sprint Cup on Saturday. Big weekend, therefore, for Doncaster. Big weekend for Montasib. Was it a race, Scott, watching that from Paris, the Sprint Cup, where you could rerun it loads of times and you get loads of different results? Or actually, at the age of six, has Montasib gone from being previously a very good handicapper to being a genuine Group One high-class sprinter?
I think it's very tempting, isn't it, especially in the sprint division, to think, oh, well, they all take turns to beat each other. But he's actually got, having had a lot of time off earlier in his career, he's still got not got that many miles on the clock. And he's got a very, very progressive profile this year. So I don't think I'd be in a hurry to knock his form at all. It's funny, really, isn't it? My first thought in watching it back this morning in preparation for this show was that there's a few jockeys there that against how well Mikel Barcelona judged the pace from the front, a few of the jockeys on the fancied runners in the Sprint Cup probably did their running in the first four furlongs and finished off quite badly, really. And actually, most of the action at the winning line would concern those that had been, relatively speaking, as much as you can over six furlong, held up. I thought obviously Kieran judged it very, very well. I thought the runner-up got a pretty good ride as well, and William Haggas's other runner, the Tubby Park horse, finished off very, very well in third as well. So it might be that with a slightly more judicious ride on some of the more fancied runners, they might have ended up in the argument. But I think Montecib is just a progressive horse, and you should ignore the fact he's six. And just think, you know, he's had however many career starts in his life. He's not had very many starts at Pack Company, and he's progressing well. So you mentioned that Charon is now a multiple Group 1 winner. I don't necessarily see any obvious reason why he's probably only got one more chance this year, but why Montecib wouldn't be a decent chance of adding to his haul at Ascot on Champions Day.
I'm inclined to agree. Are you inclined to agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just going to add that it's quite refreshing at this time of the year. Usually you have pretty much the pecking order in a lot of divisions is sort of roughly sussed out, but I really have no idea who the best sprinter in Britain is, to be honest. One minute it feels like it's in a Sharon, and then he puts in a bit of a wobbly performance and you're left scratching your head. I mean, well done to anybody who got the double of the two big races this weekend. That's all I'll say.
Wasn't me. Scott, before we wrap up, you're back at Longshot on Sunday, and this year the ARC Trials card could really have a significant impact on the ARC itself.
It could. There's a chance that we might get to see Goliath, who obviously won't have any impact on the ARC market. He is entered in the pre-foire. He has the alternative of waiting another week and going for the price for Europa in Cologne. I'm sure they'll make that decision in the next couple of days. The Preniel is a race that's kind of fallen out of fashion a bit in terms of pointing out where we should look for potential ARC winners. You've got to go back to, I think, 2006 and Rail Link for the last horse to do the double. But we'll have the first and second from the British Jockey Club. That's Luke de Vega and Sozi running in that race. There's also Ambient Friendly, the runner-up in the Derby, coming over as well. He's going to be supplemented on Thursday. So the Niel looks a cracking race. I spoke this morning to Jan Lerner, one of the co-trainers of Luke de Vega. He did his last bit of work this morning. They're very, very happy with him. He's not going to be 100% wound up, but this is an unbeaten French Derby winner. So, you know, if you can't get excited about him, you can't get excited about very much these days. Sozi was very, very good in the Grand Prix de Paris. So that looks very, very intriguing. Obviously, the Irish Champion Stakes has become almost as important a race in terms of the ARC as it is in its own right. And you've got Shin Emperor, who worked at Longchamp yesterday. He's going over. And there's, you know, economics for William Haggas, who's maybe not had the big race success we've come to associated with him in the first half of the season, but is looking to have a really, really big back end of the year with Montecib, obviously, the other day. Economics is a very, very exciting prospect. He's about to make his step into Group 1 company. So, it's a cracking weekend. I haven't even mentioned the St. Ledger yet, but it's a cracking weekend with a view to the ARC, but it's a cracking weekend in its own right as well.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Really looking forward to it. Okay, that then wraps up the programme. I have to decide who has the winning story. Great weekend of racing, but I'm not going to give it to myself. The Geldings debate is fascinating, and it will continue to run until France Galop make a decision early next year about whether Geldings can or cannot run in future ARCs. But the winning story this week should be Jonathan's on the Shark Hamlin situation, particularly, I think, in relation to what happens in future regarding aftercare and what the case of Bedelia has reminded us about. So congratulations to you, and thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us from Saint Cloud, Scott. I'm hoping a few people will join you at some point. It looks very quiet there at the moment.
Yeah, well, we're not racing for a few hours yet. Hopefully, it will. It's a twilight meeting, so hopefully, a few people will. They've had their first week back at work. They'll sidle along, maybe get out a little bit early and come along and enjoy the action here.
Yeah, and if not, let's hope they get to Longshore on Sunday for cracking up card. Enjoy that. Enjoy the rest of your week, wherever you're going or watching racing. We'll be back next week. Until then, bye-bye.